Thank you. So I prepared it as assuming a discussion. This is a talk mainly about stuff I don't understand, with a lot of teasers for theoretical physicists, TPs from now on. So feel free to stop me. It's only 94 slides, so we have plenty of time. Doesn't seem to work. Well, does it?
It works.
Good. Good. So, because I have too much slide, I never finish on time. I'm going to start by acknowledging the people who actually did the work. So I'm lucky to have two probably of the brightest students in our hallways in my group. Omer Gottesman is a graduate student. Yoav Lahini is a postdoc. And they could be curing cancer or finding alternative energy. I have a crumpling paper that is unfortunate for the world, but very lucky for me. And they've done all the work I'm going to describe here. It's the work in progress. Ariel Amir is my own personal TP, and the theoretical physicist at Harvard. He'll be here in 2 weeks. Maybe most of you probably know him. And I'll just give an overview. Basically, what I'm going to discuss is we take paper or scientific paper, mylar, and we coil it. And then we do two things with it. One is we measure mechanical properties, usually put it under some conditions, put a weight on it or under some boundary conditions, and measure the time-dependent property. So we look at how paper relaxes by measuring its strength, in a sense. The other thing we do is we open this crumpled paper up and look at it, and try to understand what network of creases is formed. And what we really want to do is kind of eventually connect the two together. And here's where we need help. So some historical background, because crumpling paper is not what I wanted to do in my life. Is how it all got started. So it all got started by with this guy again, Ariel Amir, who has a model for how systems relax. So it's a well-known phenomena for glassy materials, for real glasses, that they never reach an equilibrium, but and they never really reach a steady state. They continue to evolve. They have this property known as aging, and whatever material property you measure for these glasses, it's time dependent. And it continues to change for a very long time, usually logarithmically. And you can see it for all kinds of real glasses, electron glasses, molecular glasses. You can also see it for other disordered, not really glasses, but amorphous, glassy-like materials. For instance, ice as it's flowing, paper crumpling, which we'll talk about more, and also static frictional interface. If you measure the real area of contact, which is a good proxy for the frictional strength of materials, that also just continuously changing, logarithmically increasing in time. And together with Joe Imri, Ariel developed a very simple model that says, okay, if we assume that everything relaxes through localized modes, whatever they are, they're different in all kinds of systems, but each one of them is exponentially relaxing, and I have a broad distribution of these exponentially relaxing modes, and it's distributed like 1/rate, so very specific distribution. I do some math, and I get a logarithm. And in principle, we don't know what these modes are. It's a phenomenological model, but it fits very well a lot of data, including all kinds of funny little tails and cutoffs or whatnot. And Ariel was describing this model to me, and I said, Ariel, you're wrong. It's nonsense. Of course you're wrong. And why are you wrong? Because at least for friction, which is the one thing I know a bit, is you can measure a friction coefficient or real area of contact. And by doing a certain protocol, you can have it basically go down for a while, 100 seconds in this time, and then go back up. So it's non-monotonic. So initially something will rejuvenate. Eventually, it will begin to strengthen or relax. In other conditions, it could keep going down. So it's non-monotonic. And exponentials, no matter how you add them up, whatever distribution of rates you have, they all go in one direction. And the first response for Ariel was, OK, friction is different. Friction is not part of this universality class. And And it's boring as such. And I took that to heart. And also, you begin to develop an intuition to these systems. Once you work with enough amorphous materials and messy dielectrics or whatnot, you kind of get a sense for this universality class that does aging behavior and exhibits frustration in a very broadly defined sense of the word that inspired a lot of different phase diagrams and universality classes. You get a sense about how a system is going to behave even though you don't know much about it. And I may have made the bold hypothesis that this non-monotonic behavior is generic. This is not just a property of a friction coefficient. And to solve the argument, we decided to focus on crumpling paper. And that is because we were both postdocs at the time, and it was cheap and simple and quick way to do it. So paper is known to relax logarithmically over time. This is a beautiful measurement from the Nagel group over 7 or 8 orders of magnitude. You crumple a piece of paper, or mylar in this case. You put, so it's a thin sheet, you put a weight on it, and you measure this height over time. And it continues to go, and continues over days and weeks, eventually probably reaching a pancake, but it slows down. Now, we tried our own algorithm, and I'm going to describe it more thoroughly. So I'm not going to go into details. But you put one weight, you add another weight, you remove the first weight, and you can see this non-monotonic behavior. I'll show better data in a sense in a second. So good. Okay. So perhaps non-monotonicity is more generic for these systems. But if you want to do better, then paper is hard. And here I'm going back again to Nagel's results, where, again, the beautiful logarithm, also for tissue paper. And when you try to, quantify things by just fitting this logarithm with constants or whatnot and plot these constants, you see it's all over the map. It's very hard to get reproducible data for paper. And a smart person would have just dropped it and went to work on a more reasonable system that has perhaps applications as well. But we stuck to it, and we've been stuck with this system for quite a while. So I've been obsessed with taming crumpled paper for a long time now. And only now, when Yoav Lachini and Omer Gottesman has put their best foot forward, have we figured out how to really control paper. Which, as an experimentalist, I consider our greatest feat so far. I'm very proud of the boys for that. So here's what you do to start working with paper. Again, you choose a model system. We don't work with paper. Paper is a mess. It's very hard to buy the same paper twice. So we switch to mylar sheets. These are polymer. These are thin polymers. They're elastoplastics. You crumple them, they form scar. They're pretty well behaved. It's a pretty well behaved paper, even though it's not paper at all. You crumple it, then you can do two algorithms. One, like Nagel, you apply constant load and you measure the gap. It gives you a pretty nice logarithm. The other algorithm will be to apply a constant gap. So control the displacement, and you measure the force as the paper relaxes. So this is creep, this is relaxation, and you also measure a pretty good logarithm. Why should both be the same function? I don't know. Question number one. So, but they are. And
same slope? Is that what you meant by
no? Why? If this is a logarithm, why would this be a logarithm? Why would they both be logs? I don't know. Ariel says it's obvious. So, but that's all he says. So, I don't. It's not clear to me why. How to couple these two together? Here, I'm actually doing some work. There's no work being done. I'm quite confused about what we're doing here. It gets worse in a second. Okay.
Well, a simple linear response argument would suggest that they would be the same, but it's not obvious it's linear. I mean, have you looked at the dependence on the mass above?
We have.
I'm gonna
discuss linearity. It's way more linear than you would expect.
Ordinarily, in rheology, if you get a response in at fixed strain versus fixed stress, they'll show the same behavior.
I agree.
So also for spring,
it's surprising for paper, and it gets worse. So I agree. It's not a miracle. It just not trivial, in my sense. And again, it's going to get worse in a second. Now, the first trick to getting slightly better than that was to not use fresh paper. So you take a piece of Mylar, you crumple it, you open it up, crumple it again, and you keep going, and you keep going until your hands hurt. Okay, 20, 30, 40 times. So we do.
How does it depend with the same Mylar sheet?
No, different Mylar sheets. Everything I'm going to show you is for different Mylar sheets. All of them.
Not the same Mylar sheet that you.
Yeah, that would have been less impressive. I agree. Different Mylar. So what we can do is take fresh Mylar sheets, train them, and eventually get reproducible results for different ones. Please.
And this sounds like a crazy question to ask, but what constitutes crumpling? You know, when you crumple a piece of paper, you can do it a little bit, or you can do it a lot. Is there some maximal crumpling you can do?
How do you crumple your paper?
So we crumple papers in many different scientific ways. We crumple them with our hands to something like that, or we crumple them a bit more scientifically with crumplers, which I'll show you one in a second. It appears that it doesn't matter much. So one of the data sets I will show, we crumple to different eventually compaction rates. So we start by barely squishing it to have the volume, and eventually we squish it all the way to almost a pancake. I'll show different ones. From what I can tell so far, it doesn't matter that much how we crumple it. And again, as long as you crumple it enough times. That is the surprising thing. Okay, so by using these maximally many times crumpled papers, we start seeing something that is slightly better behaved. Now, because we also measure the force when we first insert our crumpled paper into our device, if we plot it as a function of the initial normal force, it gets even better. And we start seeing some reasonable data where, again, this is the slope of the logarithm as a function of the initial force, different sheets, different days, different times, even different people.
Each point in the
each point is one measurement.
Yeah.
So each point is one logarithm fit. So these are many measurements here.
Different sheets.
For different sheets, yes, different sheets, different days. Some of them are the same sheets, but many of them are different. Okay, and colors are only the initial gap, which we call the compaction. Okay, now it gets even better if before we start our experiment. So what we do? We have an algorithm. We have a set gap of 45 millimeters. We insert the sheet in there. We measure the force. And then we change the gap to 30, to 20, whatever, okay? And that's our experiment, okay? If before doing that we do this, it gets even better. Okay, so that's the magic. That's the voodoo. If you also add a little bit of kvetch, you can tame Mylar crumpled paper to be really reproducible. And
is this the hysteretic loop that Nagel and
Noll
observed also?
There's
different.
I don't recall their hysteretic loop. Something in the back of my mind, but I don't recall, because we're changing gap and measuring force. They changed forces and measured gaps. I don't remember. They probably did all of it. But so you do see that the initial kvetch gets you to a loop, and that loop is pretty reproducible if you keep going. Again, you have to go pretty fast, and eventually all the data collapses very well. So once you have, you know, real parameters, real aging, you can try to investigate the relaxation dynamics of paper. To answer the linearity regime, so if we measure this slope, the relaxation parameter beta, as a function of how much we compress it, again, so it's not the mass, but it's the displacement, we do see a pretty significant linear regime that breaks down at some point. So So okay, so here are the nuggets. Here I'm starting with the questions for TPs. First of all, why is a multi-crumpled paper special? Or actually, why is it not special? So each freshly crumpled piece of paper is very unique. God snowflake. But if you do it enough times, you reach some regime that appears to be not so special. They're all the same. So that's the question. What is so not special about these papers? The second one, I think less deep probably as well, what's so special about this initial fetch we're adding to the paper? Again, this is already crumpled paper. Okay, and we're not smushing it and opening it up. It's just a tiny little quetch. So we shouldn't think plasticity here, and that's a hint of what's to come. Okay, so that's the two first questions. Speaking about the non-monotonic part, this is the protocol we do. We put the paper in a 45 millimeter gap. We do a little quetch, then. We set a gap, in this case, I guess it's just below 36 millimeters. We let the system age for some whole time. So this is the gap. This is the force, okay, measured, applied by the crumpled paper. So it's logarithmically decaying, like we've seen before. Then we change the gap. We don't release it completely to 45. We just change it by a few millimeters, okay? What you see is initially you get some elastic response. Okay, so we're releasing the gap a bit, so the force is dropping down. But after that, there's a non-monotonic process. And if you zoom in, you can see that this non-monotonic process, in this case, lasts for about 100 seconds. It's very pronounced. It's very distinct. We can actually do different experiments with different hold times, different gap, and collapse all this data. And if we define the wait time and the peak time and plot them one against each other, again, we see this really inexplicable to me or oversimple linearity. Okay? And Ariel explains that, okay, if you assume, okay, you have to assume you have these modes that are relaxing exponentially, and now you have to assume that if you're reversing your if you're adding a time scale, if you're adding an extra parameter into your model, then some of the modes can work in the other direction. So you can get the non-monotonicity. But as long as you assume that all these modes are non-interacting with each other, that everything is independent, you get these linear regimes. Again, you get linearity. But it's so awkward to imagine that for a crumpled piece of paper.
Can you repeat the explanation? Adding a time scale again, just slowly. So
assume that, again, it's phenomenological, but the math takes two lines, maybe. Assume you're applying a load, you have modes relaxing at different rates. Okay? The fast ones are done very quickly, the long ones are long acting. Okay? So once you release if you had that, the fast ones have already run its course. Once you release the load, the fast ones are going to reverse and act in the other directions. The long ones are still working. Okay?
Fast modes? What kind of modes you're talking about?
The modes with the rate slower than TW.
The modes of what?
The exponential relaxation modes. The model was developed for an electron glass. So that's tunneling rates, and it makes perfect sense. What it is for a crumpled paper, I have no idea. I have no idea. But again, phenomenologically, it's independent mode. Call it a barrier model, but then a continuum barrier model. You have a distribution, exponential probability of hopping, and
convenience working on crumpling paper like this, you have two effects as you.
No, absolutely. No, we have time.
So the problem is that you have two kinds of phenomena in this. You have the friction between the self conducts, and you have also the creases themselves. So you are mixing two too close on your stuff the first year. But why do you're going further in this direction and not only talking about one of these effects, friction or creases?
I'm not talking about friction or creases. I'm talking about the only thing I've mentioned that is a pretend explanation was a phenomenological model that describes relaxation modes, which could have friction and some springing. They could all be RCs or what. I have no idea what they are. So I'm not trying to explain anything. All I'm saying is the data, if I plot it, seems to be consistent with a very trivial, linear, simple phenomenological model. That is the only statement I'm saying. It could be explained very simply, which I find a bit surprising. We can continue later. Okay, so linearity, that's the take-home message. I don't know if it's friction or creasing or whatnot. I'll get into it a bit in a second. Similarly, we can plot also the peak height. Again, the peak of the non-monotonic relaxation as a function of waiting time, and that's also quite linear. Okay, so I think the only question this is data. This is data to be explained in a model about, I think, paper with creases and buckling modes and friction and whatnot. My question is why does it appear so simple? Why are the relations between timescales linear? Why is it logarithm no matter what the loading protocol is? I'd expect it to be more complicated. Even friction itself just introduces so much nonlinearity in memory instantly that I'm surprised. But still, we don't have a model for that. Now, I think a slightly more interesting question that I've been obsessing with just lately, since we started getting this data, we had a chance to think about it a bit, is why is anything changing in time? So these systems, crumpled paper, granular piles, all these systems, which do friction coefficients, which do show time-dependent behavior, very slow tails, are always referred to as T equals zero systems. In all the jamming diagrams, in the community that works on glasses and jamming whatnot, these are T equals zero system. Temperature is not relevant. And I still don't understand why anything is happening in this system. There is some talk about, vibrations, effective temperature, noise in the environment. We tried getting rid of the noise or whatnot. This is my speculation. Okay, one more thing to think about. I think it starts with atoms vibrating and it cascades up. It doesn't cascade up and down like in equilibrium. You don't get equipartition between all scales. It leaks away and you have dissipation. But my gut instinct is that it still has to do with temperature, with real temperature. For instance, in measurements of friction coefficient and friction dynamics, it has been shown that real temperature will change the scales of these logarithms. Okay.
So for the paper experiment, have you done it at low temperatures?
We haven't. We haven't done it at low temperature.
So all of these experiments were done with this specially prepared mylar, right? So what can you tell us about the geometry of the specially prepared mylar? You've crumpled it and uncrumpled it a bunch of times, right? So what does it look like?
So what does it look like? I'll call you in a second.
Okay.
Okay? So, in a second. One word about how paper relaxes, how these logarithms and non-monotonic processes occur. A hint of it you get if you listen to it. Now, as you crumple paper, you can obviously hear a lot of crackling. But even after, under constant loads, it continues to crackle. So you can continue to listen to it. Jim Setna has done it before us. We did it again. If you listen to the paper, you get you get a lot of crackling sounds, and it continues even after days. You still hear every once in a while. It slows down, but you still hear little discrete events, which we record. And if you plot the time between events, you again get this linear distribution, which Ariel will tell us fits very well with just processes that are exponential, and the rates go and the rates go like 1 over s. What's interesting is if you look for it gets more interesting if you look for correlations. Okay, so you can plot the autocorrelation between those discrete events, and you can plot the probability of getting an event at time delta t after a previous event. Okay, so we plot the probability of getting an event as a function of delta time over the absolute time, right? Because they slow down. And instead of getting this straight line, just Poissonian distribution, as you would expect for a memoryless model, for a correlationless model, we get these high probability events. Basically, we get these avalanches. And if you look back at the data here, it's not just noisy and broadly distributed. You literally see clusters of events occurring. And sometimes you can even identify a height or force drop corresponding to it. So there are some correlations in these events. And I always assume that the crackling and relaxation has to do with plasticity, with friction, with a lot of processes that are very dissipative, that what I'm seeing is creases being formed. Apparently, I was the only one assuming that. What Yoav explained to me is actually all the crackling modes, all the relaxation modes are mostly due to buckling of faces. So this is a crumpled piece of mylar, it's opened up, but what you can see is you see these creases and vertices as you'd expect, and between them you have faces. And these faces could be up or down, and if you look at them very closely as this paper is manipulated, maybe we can even hear something. No. Do you see it? See these discrete jumps? Many scales. Now the movie actually has sound. Every one of them will be... And every once in a while you'll hear an avalanche. So every one of those relaxation events has to do with snap buckling of faces, much more than new creases being formed. Okay? So that's the mechanics we should be thinking about.
If I remember correctly, in NAGE 2002 paper, there was an estimation of the work in the process, the elastic work and the frictional work. If I recall, the friction was dominant. Maybe I'm wrong.
I remember something, but I don't remember. I really don't. So they had let's get into it later. They had a one-parameter model. So in the actual model for the relaxation, they had a one degree of freedom model, again phenomenological, and so there was no separation of mechanism there. Also, I don't remember the estimation they did about friction versus plasticity, creasing, you mean, or versus elasticity.
Friction versus elastic buckling energy.
During relaxation or during the time dependent?
Yes. But I might be wrong, it was more of a question, but
so I don't remember what they measured. It's inconsistent with what I think we're saying.
And another related thing is if it was a purely elastic sheet, buckling would occur.
Yeah. Maybe.
How much would remain?
I have no idea.
You haven't tried
purely elastic or purely plastic.
Another thing, when you make so under tension and under compression, does it behave the same thing? You showed this when it is under tension.
No.
I believe that there is snapping, a lot of snapping. But in crumpled paper, you are, if you compress more and more, I don't see how snapping occurs in this configuration of
So you don't believe me.
I don't believe you.
I don't know what paper looks like on the inside. We've been avoiding doing X-rays, which is the only way to really know what. But you know, within the crumpled paper, I mean, and it's still the volume fractions are about 10%. You have these faces. Some of them are under tension. Some of them are under compression. If you see this movie again, just towards the end, let's see if I can locate it somehow. To do that. After everything is released, okay. So wait for the finger to release, and you still see a few events occurring. Well, it's a short movie. All you need is one. To prove that it's possible. So,
you see,
boom, boom, boom. They continue to happen, right? So,
but it's not at all scales. What I see is one big event. But okay,
sorry. I don't know what all scales mean. But what do you think the sounds are?
For sound is related to friction or something like this.
Friction doesn't make this kind of sound with paper. It's very discrete, popcorn-like sounds. Snap buckling makes that exact sound. It sounds exactly like this, also in the spectrum. Friction?
By the way,
sounds completely different.
Do you have a typical signature of
We do, and we should look at it more carefully. It's on the list. It's on the list. Yeah, Dan.
Are the avalanching crackles spatially correlated?
We don't know. So we just started looking at a system like that, which may or may not have anything to do with crumpled paper, but we don't have any spatial information. We've tried a few microphones and doing some seismology. It's too hard. It's a hard system to work on, so plenty of questions. Okay, so to get back to what Chris was asking, one of the things we focused on was what's so special or not special about the well-crumpled paper. Okay, and to do that, we started crumpling it in a slightly more scientific way. So this is our crumpler for this experiment. Omer crumples the mylar into a cylinder, and then squishes it, opens it up, scans it with a profilometer he built, and does it again, scans it again, and continues to do so with every piece of paper for 20 times, for 30 times, for 40 times. Sometimes he inverts the paper before recrumpling it, or turns it 90 degrees. He tried all the versions, and in order to do it very well, the important thing was to be able to do it fast, because we wanted to do a lot of data. So a lot of work was done by Omer to get his system in a way where he can get basically these images, the topographies, and then curvatures of crumpled papers very quickly, in minutes. And then he can do these experiments where he crumples a paper 30, 40 times. When we started it, each scan took 20 minutes. We couldn't get the data. We couldn't learn anything. It was too hard. But now we're there, and you'll see that why that's important. So you scan the paper, you crumple the paper, you open it up, you scan it, and from that you can get, for instance, the mean curvatures. And once you do that, so red are valleys and blue are ridges, of course. This is arbitrary. Choice, and once you do that, you can do that as a function of how many times you crumpled the paper. So this is the first crumple to some volume fraction we call delta, some compaction rate delta.
And what is the threshold defining a value?
So here there is no threshold for now. For now, this is just the mean curvature.
When you see a red line ends, it's still curvature
less.
Right. So there is some threshold.
So here, So here there is no thresholding. This is just colors. This is a color map. Trussen, or okay. Trust Omer. That's a threshold. Less. You'll see more and more bluish and reddish or whatnot. It's just when you have the creases, they're really blue. And when you don't have them, they're less blue. So this is without a threshold, evolving over crumples. Then you can define some threshold, and we tried many things, and then you can call it creases. Okay? And we tried different kinds of thresholds. It doesn't matter in the sense that no matter what we did, we couldn't do it well enough to describe a network. Okay, so what we really wanted to do, and others have done before us, let's look at this, is to define networks of vertices and ridges and connectivity and work in a world of lines and junctions. And we never got it to be good enough. Our lines kept breaking down and whatnot. So instead we looked at a very primitive parameter, an arbitrary one. We looked at the total length of creases in the system. Okay, so basically just once you threshold it, measure how much red pixels you have. We don't know if it's one crease or 100 or where they start, but at least we're less sensitive to little holes. If we were looking for distribution of ridge sizes, this would kill us. But if all we want is the total mileage of creases, that's a parameter. So if we look at that as a function of a number of crumples, it actually gets it's actually quite interesting. So this is the valleys and the ridges. Different lines in that direction corresponds to different compaction ratios. Now, if you zoom in here, it's a mess. It's a mess. The initial number, the initial mileage of creases, even for a given crumple, this is, again, freshly crumpled paper. I mean, the errors here are 50%, 100%. It's a mess. But once you continue to track it and measure the mileage, you can see that each one of those lines are at least 2 to 3, sometimes more, measurements. It's very reproducible, actually. So the evolution of this network is quite well defined. If you plot it in log-log, I was quite convinced that we're seeing a two-thirds law. Then I was convinced we're seeing a half law. And the reason is it's not clear what we're seeing. So unfortunately, it's not clear we're seeing whether or not we're seeing one kind of scaling, no scaling at all, or a mess. So the measurements are reproducible. They seem pretty straight on a log-log plot, but not quite.
What is the x-axis? What is
the n? So the n is the crumple number. So freshly crumpled is n equals 1.
It's the same as capital N.
It's the same as capital N. Yes, I go back and forth here. Okay. Apologies. Now, what is actually more robust and quite well defined is what happens if we choose a specific n and look at the different deltas. Okay, so by going along n, it means I take one piece of mylar and I crumple it many times. By going along delta, I'm actually comparing weird experiments. Okay, I had to crumple each piece of mylar n times to different compaction rates. But when I look at the total crease length as a function of the compaction, I see a very clear exponential. And again, you have to give credit to the students. Each one of those dots required crumpling. Well, if it's n equals 15, the green one, 15 times, scanning it 15 times and tracking it. And there we see a very nice exponential decay. So
L valleys or L valleys plus L, because the valleys are L.
No, this is just L valleys.
Okay.
What's the question?
No, if you make the total length of valleys as function of total length of the other stuff, how do you increase? Of ridges.
If you look at the total length of ridges and the function of the total length of valleys,
do you have some relationship between them?
So initially, you always get more of the one than the other. I think it's, well, it depends on how you orient it, just because you're crumpling a cylinder inwards. So initially, there's always one is bigger than the other. Eventually, you lose that, if I remember correctly. Am I confusing you again?
No, it's good.
Good. So, but here I'm only talking about the valleys, but ridges would show
the same thing.
The same behavior. Yes. In that sense, it does. Okay. So, why is L exponential in delta? That is another question. Now, it raised another question. So here's an experiment. I think it's a game, but we were surprised by the result. So Omer crumples his Mylar, let's say small n times to one delta. Then he continues to crumple it to another delta. Okay? So initially he crumples, okay, so these are two master curves. Then he crumples his paper five times along the black curve. And then continues to do it to a much deeper delta, okay, along the blue curve. Okay, so you skip from, so you depart from the black curve, you get more creases because you're crumpling it more, it's a smaller volume fraction. If you displace the curve, basically just moving it along here, it tracks that curve perfectly. Okay, again, something very, very simple. All it cares about is the instantaneous mileage, instantaneous L, not how it got there. If I do the same thing in the other direction, I start at the high volume fraction, high compaction. And I go the other way, same thing. Okay? So, two conclusions. The system, in a sense, is memoryless. But what surprises me more is it actually means that the total mileage, this arbitrary length parameter we defined, just because this is the only thing we could measure, means something. It's something the system, the physics, identify. It's actually a real parameter. Yes?
Does this suggest that the angle of the creases doesn't give you anything about the physics? That everything is contained in the length?
It suggests that a lot is contained in the length. So, it's still work in progress. We're still arguing whether or not we can tell the difference between these two. So same length, but different trajectories, whether or not. Initially, just looking at them by eye, it seemed like the lower volume fractions had bigger features, they were less dense. Now I'm not so sure. So that's an open question. It does suggest that total length of creases is some meaningful parameter.
Are the pictures that you were showing, the lines, scaling invariant, or do they have a characteristic size?
I don't know. We only tried one size.
But as you change things, the shape of these patterns changes. What I'm asking is, within one of those pictures, is the typical size of the branching, let's say, 1/5 of the size of the paper?
So we haven't tried different paper sizes, which would be the right thing to do. Looking for some self-similar shape inside the paper, we couldn't find it. But again, it's a bit messy data. I'll show you the closest we got. It's trying a different size paper. Comparing it, it's the right thing to do. But this is quite virginous. So the ability to actually look at paper and say, I'm looking at this dot, I'm looking at the pattern here, and I think it means something, because it's part of a reproducible curve. And now I can go to a different size paper or whatnot. We just got there. So this is quite preliminary. So now we can do it. Before that, I think it was meaningless, because whatever you do, you're looking at a whole new creation. So. We're on our way there. What we did do...
Now, Shmuel, we've got about 5 minutes left in our room reservation. So why don't you end with the last most important things that you want to present.
Okay, I'll end with this. It is the last thing. So what we could do now is try to see if we can make sense of how the pattern is formed, if there's any correlations in there, if there's any logic to it. So what we can do is we can look at a crease pattern. We can look at the crease pattern next time we crumple it. We can look at the difference between them, and then we can start looking for scaling or doing some box counting. So the simplest thing to do is to look at boxes of different size and to say what is the probability of finding a crease there, and of course, what if I find a crease there, what is the probability of having another crease appear in that box? So this is what we do. So what do we have? We have red. So for different box sizes, red will be the probability of having a crease in that box size. Blue would be the probability of having a new crease in that box size. And magenta will be the probability of having two creases there. That's not very informative, but when I compare the probability of having an old crease in a box to the probability of having an old crease given that I know I have a new crease in that box, that actually means something. Because if there were no correlations, if they were completely independent, these two curves should overlap. Okay? So when I look at these two together, and even more informatively, when I plot them, the ratio between the two, one would be what I'd expect to get from uncorrelated events. This is what I get in the actual paper. And again, I don't really believe this peak. It's an artifact. But if we just look at the box size of 4, and for a box size of 4, compare for different deltas, the dynamics of evolution, we see again that we're above 1 as a function of n for many different compaction rates. So the closest we have to describing these dynamics and where do exponentials eventually come from and whether or not we have powers is to say that creases are actually attracted to other creases. The more you compact it, so blue and red, the more you compact it, it's actually less correlated. And the more times you compact it, also, you begin to lose correlations. So this is what we have for paper. Lots of mainly lots of questions, but I would say quite a bit of good data, even though Mukhtar doesn't like it. It's still good. So any I'm happy with any explanation for it, and good people. I must love that. Thank you.